Welcome to Let's Talk Learning Disabilities with Lori Peterson. Lori spends her days talking about dyslexia, dysgraphia, dyscalculia, and ADHD. She talks to students and adults who have had a lifetime of academic challenges. She's here to share their stories along with other insights with you. So let's talk learning disabilities.
Hey everybody, this is Lori and welcome back to Let's Talk Learning Disabilities. Today we are going to do something new. We are doing a Hot Topics episode. So today we are going to dig into what's happening right now in the world of learning disabilities and ADHD. I am joined by Sydney and Kara, who you have heard from before in previous episodes, and they are joining me today so that we can talk about some what we think are hot topics. But here's the thing. Well, supposedly they may have talked, but none of us know what the others are bringing to the table today. We each are going to show up with a story, a topic, something that caught our attention this week, and we're going to talk about it honestly in real time. So whether you're a parent, an educator, or someone that's navigating this yourself, we're very glad you are here. So let's get into it. All right. Hi, Sydney. Hi, Kara.
Hi, Lori.
Hi there.
Okay. So who wants to go first? Sydney, I'm calling on you. Tell us what you got today.
That's fine. Yes.
All right. Bring it.
Okay. So mine is, I guess, it is a topic, but it's an interesting study that I found that they just did this year, actually. And so the study is titled Specific Learning Disabilities, Disparities in Identification.
Okay.
And essentially what they have done is in at the University of Oxford in England, they did this massive study with like 540,000 students across like 15,000 schools. So it's like a big, significant study. And essentially what they wanted to do was they wanted to analyze a bunch of data to see what predicts whether a student gets identified with a specific learning disability. And what they found is slightly uncomfortable, but the three of us are also kind of aware of the information that comes from this data. It's something that we see pretty frequently, but I don't think it's something that a lot of everyday parents, teachers, or just educators see. So essentially what they found is that there are a lot of kind of discrepancies of how a student gets identified. A lot of it was based on socioeconomic conditions. So if they are in a school where the test scores and, you know, kind of academic standards are already really low, they found a significant decrease in students actually getting identified with learning disabilities. A lot of the times it was language. So if it was a student learning English as a second language, a lot of the time what they would find is people would just jump right into, well, it's probably just the language learning rather than identifying some kind of underlying struggle. Mm-hmm. It's something that we talk about pretty consistently, especially with ADHD, I think. But one of the bigger pieces that they found was that women are least likely to get identified, which, surprise, surprise, it was pretty significant, especially with the ADHD and the dyslexia, because girls tend to compensate a little bit better and mask a little bit better. So it's interesting to have that in some very bold-faced data rather than us just, you know, saying, well, we've seen this across the years, but now we actually have data to show that. Another thing that they found in it was if you have a struggling student that is surrounded by very high-performing peers, it's going to stand out very, you know, it'll stand out. So people are going to say, you know what, this kid is not meeting the standards of everyone else around them. But in an environment where the overall student performance is lower, it blends in. And so those students that are in those lower environments are just not getting identified.
Okay, so I'm curious as to like, what was the, did they make any recommendations as to sort of how to rectify this? Because it's absolutely true. I mean, Kara, you know, from being in the schools, it depends on your school and the environment. So how do you fix that?
Yeah, so as far as what they were doing, I think really the main point was to try to identify some of the discrepancies, because very clearly, you know, over the years, there has been a lot of people that have brought up students just, you know, not getting identified properly. So I think the main goal was just to identify some of these factors. I will 100% need to read into the study a little bit because it's a pretty extensive study. It is not, not small by any means. but I would love to read into it a little bit further and see what even, I don't think they provided any specific recommendations as far as how to kind of remedy that. I think really the main goal is just to find the implications for like practice and policy for like educators and schools.
Right. And just raise awareness.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's, again, we see it every day in what we do, but I don't think the general public is really aware of how big discrepancies there are in, you know, identifying learning disabilities based on, you know, where the student is going to school, how old they are, their gender, you know, their socioeconomic conditions. So it's just very interesting and something that we have talked about before.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting too, because we see the discrepancy with ADHD and women, right? Like that's, we've talked about that, but I didn't really think about it with dyslexia and women that, but now that you say that, it does make sense because girls in school tend to be a little bit more of a pleaser. They tend to not want to like ruffle anybody's feathers. They don't want to bring awareness to themselves. And so they just mask and they mask whether it's ADHD, dyslexia, or any other learning disability. But that's, I'd never heard it said about anything other than ADHD, but it does make sense.
And that's so interesting that you say that, because when I was in the schools, we typically always would say the identification of autism sometimes could be difficult in girls. And then I was on the autism team many, many moons ago. And then sometimes we'd have referrals for girls in high school because they've masked all these years and they look a little different. And so it's very interesting, the gender aspect.
That is awesome. I love Absolutely. That. Oh.
And I think the part good. That, girl power, I think the interesting part that really kind of stuck with me is, you know, kind of asking the question now of, you know, educators in schools is, are students being identified really based on access or their environment or context? Because we talk to parents every day and they're like, you know, the school says they're fine. They don't qualify for supports. You know, they're not far enough behind where the school will even test. But then as the parent is describing to us what they're seeing, you know, taking hours to complete homework, you know, emotional meltdowns when they get home from school, really low self-esteem, you know, their kid cries every morning before they go to school. And that is not an experience of a student that is doing well in school. And it really doesn't match up with a student that you would think is doing really well. And then, you know, once we evaluate, it becomes very clear that there is something wrong. So I think it is really important because that probably validates a lot of families based on, you know, what they might have been told from the school. And not to make the schools seem malicious or anything, because really sometimes they just don't have the resources to properly identify or evaluate so many students,
sure.
especially if the teachers aren't trained in, you know, identifying the signs of dyslexia. But the main takeaway I would take from that is that we need to have some more kind of comprehensive, information given to students or given to teachers, given to administrators. So that way it's not a matter of, you know, they go to a fancy school, everyone's really high performing. So you're going to stand out a lot more and get identified that way.
Yeah, we need a better screening process, which I know in some states we've tried to implement. I know Texas has got a screening process, but I think it needs to be more nationwide and it probably needs to be a little bit more thorough and a little bit better analyzed, the data that you get from that. That's awesome.
Absolutely. And even though this study was done in the UK, I 100% think we would find the exact same thing here in the US.
100%. 100%. 100% applicable. I agree. Well, that was awesome. Okay. Yeah. Good one.
And even though great. That wasn't really a hot topic because, you know, it's information.
No, it really is,
actually. I think it's really interesting to have a study done on that scale.
No, I think it is. I think that is a hot topic because I do think the identification process is lagging and lacking. And I think that that's something we're always dealing with. So it really kind of is always going to be a current topic. I don't know that we'll ever get it fixed, but we can improve it.
True.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Kara. We can talk about it.
Absolutely. Kara, what'd you bring to the table today?
So my favorite, this is my favorite hot topic, is visual processing. And so, Sydney, you mentioned something a little while ago about like students struggling and like at home having hours of homework or things that they're doing that takes an extra long time and they're working harder than their peers. And it seems like they're doing okay, but it's just taking them a bunch of extra time. I had a follow-up appointment yesterday with a family, and that's exactly what the student expressed. He's like, it takes me so much longer to do things than everybody else, and I never could figure out why. And he's, you know, has really high scores. And so there's no reason for him to not be performing at the same rate as his peers, other than we learn that he has a possible visual processing deficit. And so I think that visual processing is different or is the same as like just your visual acuity. So what your eyes just see, but it's actually the way the brain processes what your eyes see. And so students can have this problem where they're reversing letters because of the way their brain sees the letters or processes the way they see the letters. You know, they have difficulty copying words from the board. It takes them lots of times looking up, looking back, looking up, looking back, tracking. When they write, they have difficulty with spacing, with the orientation of, you know, the line, just writing above the line, writing below the line, the spacing in between words, the spacing in between letters, the size of the letters, just being different, just with math, not being able to line up, you know, being able to do the math, but visually not being able to line the numbers up to be able to calculate correctly. I mean, there's just so many ways that visual processing impacts students, and just with a little bit of attention, you know, it could totally solve a lot of problems. Now,
I'm curious, the student that you met with yesterday, what were some of the symptoms he had experienced that were kind of the red flag for the visual processing?
So he actually, it was his writing. Now, it was comorbid with dysgraphia, which it definitely can be comorbid with dyslexia, dysgraphia, ADHD, all the things. But it also could explain why they're showing some of those characteristics of those learning disorders as well. So,
I think what's the most frustrating about that is that when you're as a student, you don't know what you don't know. So
absolutely.
How you see things is just, you're just assuming. So you don't know to make a stink about it because you just assume I just must be slow, you know, without someone being able to like crawl into your head and look through your eyes, you don't know that you're seeing things differently. So that to me is one of the more frustrating aspects of it.
And that's exactly what he said, straight from his mouth. It's like, this helps me so much because I could not figure out why. And he's in 12th grade.
Wow.
So yeah, this whole time he's just like, I've been working so hard. It takes me a long time to complete my assignments and my friends are always just done. And I'm just still there just doing it. I mean, and he has scores in the 130s, the 120s.
Right.
So he's very, very bright and capable.
I'm curious, how did he do on the visual perceptual stuff on the testing as far as like part whole relationships, spatial, like doing puzzles?
He did fine.
Yeah. That's what's always so confusing.
In fact, it was one of his higher scores. Mm-hmm. And he said he loves playing games like Minecraft and, you know, Legos and puzzles when he was younger. Like, he loves all of that stuff. And so he wasn't surprised that that score was high. But yes.
But that even makes it more of a puzzle, right? Because it's like, exactly. Well, how could you do these puzzles if it's a visual processing thing? And I always try to explain it's like the gross motor and fine motor of your vision, right? Like gross motor, I can do puzzles, I can put things together. But when it gets down to the fine motor of having to track across the page or copy, that's where the difficulty really kicks in. So that is so cool. I think that's always going to be a hot topic because I feel like it's still such a hidden issue and that kids get misdiagnosed with dyslexia or other, you know, dysgraphia, which obviously can be comorbid, but it also can be a lot of the reason why they're seeing those symptoms.
Exactly. Exactly.
So I'm curious, as you guys are both former educators, and now that you, you know, have this experience in working with students now and are aware of what a visual processing issue is, do you often just kind of think back onto when you were educators or when you were doing, you know, ARD meetings and things like that, or being a school diag, and you're like, how many of these kids actually had a visual processing issue?
Absolutely. Yes. And because sometimes the NQ, a student, which is they do not qualify based on the criteria, but there is a disconnect between how they performed on the test versus how they perform in the classroom. And, you know, it's always like frustrational because the teacher wants to help the student. You know, they want them to have services. They feel they need specially designed instruction because of the way they are performing in the classroom. But there's that disconnect as to, but they have the ability, you know, to do grade level work, but there's something missing. Something's missing. And I truly believe that a lot of the times that this was the missing piece.
I think it's way more common than we think it is or that we even know about.
So fascinated by this whole concept.
Do you think that visual processing issues should be taken into account when the schools are doing their assessments?
I think 100%. So. I do. I think so. As I mentioned before, I'm not sure what
that process would look like realistically.
wouldn't if the school, and Kara, you probably can answer this because I've been out for so long, but I feel like if you make a diagnosis like that, it's kind of why we aren't allowed to like refer kids to like outside for ADHD testing, at least in one, I know in my district, we weren't allowed to, because then it's like, then the district has to pay for it. I feel like if we can't provide the remediation for it,
that's
then
exactly
it's not something
right.
we can diagnose. If we can't do the vision therapy or provide you with the correct lenses, then we can't
that's
diagnose
exactly
it
right.
because the school is scared of spending the money to have to pay for someone to go do it.
That's exactly right.
Comes down to money.
Interesting. Now that's a hot take.
That is because that's a lot of kids. That's a lot of kids.
Yeah.
I mean, if I think about all the ones that we've identified, mm-hmm. And you know, it's exponential from there, the kids that we don't even see.
Yes. But you know, what's eye-opening for me is that when we do the re-evaluations for students who you've identified
vision therapy
years and years ago that they've had the therapy. I mean, I literally one time sat in a follow-up with a family and they asked me to pull up the scores from the previous evaluation and the scores changed so much. They went up so much as their daughter completed the vision therapy when it was first diagnosed. And so she hated it is what they said. She hated it, but it helped her. And I was like, well, you need to tell her that this has really, really helped her.
It helps with the reading fluency. It helps with spelling. It helped. I mean, so many things.
Even her cognitive scores
yeah.
went up in some
that
areas.
That's
so
awesome.
It's just very interesting.
And we continue to learn. And that's what I love about it too, is it's evolving and there's still so much we don't know about it because that's not necessarily, we're not optometrists, but
exactly.
we keep investigating and keep researching and keep seeing kids that it's like, wow, this is amazing. So good hot topic.
Thank you. And
good
maybe I'll
topic.
Move along for a little bit.
No, don't. See, we got to get the awareness out there. We got to keep spreading the word, keep spreading the word. So you guys are going to be really surprised
Boy.
That my hot topic is on ADHD.
I knew it.
I know, but I couldn't help it because this one was kind of cool.
Shocker.
So bear with me because I'm going to be kind of reading from an article because it's a lot. Again, like yours, it was a study. So the Journal of American, it's the American Medical Association for Psychiatry published an article back in February. So just a couple months ago. And it is about the three types of ADHD, but looking at them through brain mapping and redefining those three types of ADHD. So let me just read you a little bit of this. And I hate to just read, but it is super, super interesting. So for decades, ADHD has been treated basically as one condition with three possible presentations, inattentive, hyperactive, impulsive, a little bit of both. By looking at brain scans from over 1,000 children, researchers were able to identify three distinct brain-based subtypes of ADHD called biotypes that each have their own unique brain patterns, symptom profile, and long-term outcomes. But here's what makes this really cool. The researchers did not use any symptoms checklists to create these groups. They let the brain data lead the way, and the groups that emerge actually lined up with the symptom-based categories we already use. Mm-hmm. So that to me was super cool, that while we have those three categories and the symptoms all fit perfectly, research is showing us that the brain patterns and the data from brain scans matches those three areas. So they looked, like I said, it was over 1,000 kids that already had ADHD. They mapped how different regions of the brain were connected to each other and looked for patterns where things were developing atypically. They found that they naturally fell into these three distinct groups based on their brain patterns, and then they matched them up with a category. So let me go over the three biotypes really fast. So the first biotype is severe combined with emotional dysregulation. So this is our combined type, but we're tweaking a little bit because now we're adding that emotional dysregulation. So these children show the highest level of both inattention and hyperactivity impulsivity. The defining features of this group is significant emotional dysregulation, meaning they have a much harder time managing big feelings, recovering from frustration, and regulating their emotional responses compared to the other two groups. They are also more likely to develop anxiety or depression over time. So who this might sound like? The child who seems to fall apart emotionally over things others can brush off. The ones whose ADHD also comes with big, hard to manage feelings. Parents often describe these kids as exhausting and heartbreaking in equal measure. Adults in this group may have been told they are too sensitive or too intense on top of their ADHD. Okay, so biotype number two is your hyperactive impulsive. So not the combined, just the predominantly hyperactive impulsive. Oh, and I meant to say, it does talk about the brain areas involved. So like in the biotype one, the brain area involved is widespread changes in the prefrontal cortex, the brain's command center for decision-making, impulse control, and emotional regulation. So for biotype two, they look at the anterior cingulate cortex, which is involved in impulse control and decision-making. And the pallidum. Oh, I'm saying these wrong. But anyway, that plays a role in movement and motion. So that's, I know, clearly. So what the biotype two looks like, which is your hyperactive impulsive, these children show more hyperactivity, impulsivity than inattention. Their emotional dysregulation tends to improve over time on its own, which is a more hopeful trajectory. The good news for this group is that without medication, their emotional regulation tends to get better as they get older. This might sound like the classic bouncing off the wall presentation, the child who blurts out answers, can't wait their turn, acts before thinking. I think this might be me. Educators often find this group the most disruptive in a classroom setting, but the research suggests this group may actually have a better long-term trajectory than the biotype one. So those are your bouncing off the wall kids, but less emotional. And then, as you can probably guess, the biotype three is our mostly inattentive. And this is looking at a parts of the brain I definitely can't pronounce, so I'm not even going to try. But what it looks like. These children show the most prominent attention difficulties with less hyperactivity. Their brain deviations are actually the most focused and least widespread of these groups, which may be why they are often the last to get identified. They are not disruptive. They are just quietly struggling. Who this might sound like? The daydreamer. The child who stares out the window, loses track of instructions, forgets to turn in homework, even when it's done. Often girls, but not exclusively. Adults in this group frequently report being diagnosed late in life, sometimes not until college or adulthood, because they managed to get by through sheer effort and compensation strategies until the demands got too high. So the interesting thing is these three groups are the same three groups we talk about, but now we just have the brain data to back it up, which I find incredibly cool. Like, we are right. We're on the right track.
So very validating.
It is very validating. And what it really makes me think is, are we heading towards a place where diagnosing comes from a brain scan? How cool would that be?
Wouldn't that be great? Then we wouldn't have, then people wouldn't be able to fall back onto ADHD isn't real. It's just a lack of effort. Try harder.
Absolutely. And it's not anybody's opinion. Because, right. You know, even though we have an objective measure for attention and focus and all that, it's still, there's not like it's a medical diagnosis without a medical test.
Right. And then it would help women like me in my age group try to decipher between whether it's just, I just have so much on my plate and I'm just having a really hard time doing that. Whereas, and you know, when I was younger, I didn't have all these things. So it's a good way to help us filter out, you know, whether it actually is or not, or if it's still.
Speaking of women, there has been a lot of studies that have come out lately about how much hormones impact ADHD, especially in older women, especially women that are going through menopause, and how it just ramps it up times 10. And so we talk to a lot of adult women that call us and they're like, you know, I didn't really struggle with attention and a lot of these things, but now, you know, I'm in my 40s and 50s and I am crashing and burning. And I'm like, we're seeing a lot of that. And a lot of these studies are backing that data up, is that hormones just make it 10 times worse.
Yep. It exacerbates everything.
For women like that, they think about how their whole life, they just did things at the last minute and just prided themselves on just, you know, I work great under pressure. Yes. Or, you know, they've been time blind and they're late everywhere. And so, you know, just all these different things they think about that have happened, you know, or symptoms that they have that they didn't know, you know, were characteristics of ADHD. And so anyway, I believe that this is great and in the right direction. For sure.
I think it's going to help us with the treatment part too, because really understanding the biology of the exactly. three different types, I think we'll take away some of the guessing game that we play with medication, right? Because at the end of the day, it really is a trial and error, and it's exhausting and it can be incredibly frustrating. And that's a lot why a lot of parents don't even want to go down that road, because it's like, I don't want to play the guessing game. But now if we can pinpoint exactly where the ADHD is having its impact from the brain's perspective, then we know how to treat it. And I had another article that I actually wanted to talk about too, that was, we'll save for another day, but it was more about how we are treating it with stimulants and maybe not stimulating the brain and trying a different route by raising dopamine or whatever is a more productive route. So I think this just leads into that there are going to be, we're going to find better ways to treat it because we're going to know more about the biology of it. So this to me was super exciting. It does make me want to go get a brain scan. Absolutely. I'm not going to, but it does make me want to go get one just to see like that validation of probably having either biotype 1 or 2, but yeah. Yeah. So that was very cool.
I think it's interesting because I think a logical next step for that afterwards is, now that we have brain scans as far as identifying ADHD, it'd be interesting to see the brain scans once someone is medicated and compare those results. Ooh. To be able to see, is this truly working? Is this helping those specific parts of the brain we can see being affected by the ADHD? So that would be very interesting to see as well.
That would be very cool. That would be very, very cool. Well, girls, thank you so much for doing this. I have wanted to do something on current events, hot topics for so long, and we're definitely doing it again. But I really appreciate you guys doing the research and bringing your topics today. Listeners, if something we talked about today resonated with you, we'd love to hear about it. You can reach us at letstalklearningdisabilities@gmail.com. Or if you have a hot topic you think we should cover, don't hesitate to let us know. If you're not already subscribed to our podcast, please go find us and please subscribe. And if this episode was helpful, the best thing you can do is share it with someone that needs it. A fellow parent, a teacher, a friend who was just diagnosed. Word of mouth is everything for a show like ours. So thank you guys for being here. Thank you, girls. And we will see you guys next time on Let's Talk Learning Disabilities. Bye, everyone.
Bye. Thank you, Lori.
Thank you so much for joining us today. In our show notes, you can find information about today's talk, as well as links to resources and other episodes. If you have questions about today's talk, have ideas for future episodes, or just want to stay connected, you can contact us through Diagnostic Learning Services on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Instagram. So, let's keep talking learning disabilities. This podcast is sponsored by eDiagnostic Learning. You can find more information at www.ediagnosticlearning.com.